Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 165. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we discuss a case study about planning your digital archaeological strategy. Let's get to it. Welcome to the show, everybody. Paul, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Yeah, I'm just chilling at home right now, working on a bunch of projects because I've got a big project coming up that I'll like to tell you a little bit about. How are you doing? Where are you?
We are currently in Tucson, Arizona. I'm looking out the front window of my RV right now at a whole bunch of saguaro cactuses. We're literally surrounded. We're right outside the national park, which is not a closed national park like a lot of them are. You can just drive right through this thing. They have a visitor center where you can go in and pay a fee if you're going to be ethical about it. And I think they've got some camping in other parts of the year and stuff too. But we're actually in a campground that's basically, it's not part of the park. It's in the Tucson Mountain Park, it's called. It's more of a county or maybe a state thing. I don't really know, but it's exactly the same as the national park because I can probably see the national park, you know, a few hundred feet away. It's not that far. So really cool area though. We've seen coyotes. We've seen the cactuses are just, or cacti, if you will, are just crazy. I was walking out of the car the other day and a piece of cholla, if you've ever come in contact with that, got, I didn't realize it, but clipped onto my heel. And then when I moved my right foot past my left ankle, as you walk, it jammed into my ankle. And then I had to basically sit down and pull spine by spine, as it was already well embedded, this cholla spines out of my ankle.
Yeah, sounds like you're having a great time.
Welcome to the desert. There you go. So how was that shovel testing project that we talked about last time? How'd that go?
No, it went great. You know, it's a CRM project, so I can't talk about it in too much detail, but you know, you help settle my nerves a little bit. And I went up there and it was a small crew, just four of us total, including the field director, the field supervisor. And yeah, what a great bunch of guys. So we did some, you know, it was hard work, digging a lot of holes in the fields, some in woods, usually in rose bushes, wild rose bushes, which are my new best worst friend.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, I don't like them. And yeah, we didn't find anything. I think I can say that because I haven't said where or why or with whom, but it was so much fun though. I've always liked field work. And, you know, and I think you got a sense of that when I was out in Nevada with you. I just kind of enjoy being in the field. And this was the same sort of thing. Very, very different conditions, very, very different kind of work. But it was fun. It just feels healthy. And then in the evenings, I sit around with the guys on the porch and drink some beers and talk archaeology. Yes. And they're really, really bright. So we had some interesting discussions about the various kinds of archaeology, archaeology in different parts of the world, differences between academic and CRM archaeology. So I just filled my head every night with different ideas and things I hadn't thought of and new things to learn. And it was a blast.
Nice. That's really cool. You know, I'm curious if you guys saw any of these. I worked in Vermont one time. That's really my only Northeastern archaeology experience. It was just outside Burlington and then outside Stowe a little bit. And one of the things, like the Burlington part, whatever, we were under a transmission line, didn't see much. It was all basically cleared out for access to the transmission line. But then a small contingent of us went out near Stowe and we're basically, I have no idea why we were digging, where we were digging, but we were traipsing through the woods across property lines and other things. And we would cross when we were going to like little areas where we were shovel testing. We weren't grid shovel testing. We were spot shovel testing. And I'm not, again, I have no idea why we were doing that, but we would cross these like stone fences that are sometimes a couple hundred years old. And you worked with us in Nevada. Every time we crossed a road, we had to think, hey, we should record this because it's probably historic. But we didn't even give those stone fences a second thought when we were on that project.
We had two of those on the property that we were on, both of them just inside the woods. And basically, they bounded a drainage. And than the fields on either side. And we didn't bother recording them. It didn't really matter insofar as the scope of the project. And I'm totally familiar with those because every time I go hiking in this area, and like I said before, it's only half an hour north of where I live, that's how all the woods are. They're just littered with old stones because all the woods around here are second growth. Right. Sure. So at some point it was farmland, and, you know, poor farmer 100, 150, 200 years ago went with his oxen and, you know, piled up all the rocks that they could get out. And it's very rocky soil. You know, it's pretty good loam, but it's tons of rocks. I think mostly glacial deposits. I'm not certain.
I think you're probably
Know better. But, you know, of all sorts of different kinds. You know, so we get slate, we get chunks of granite, we get river cobbles, little broken bits of this and that, lots of quartz pieces, you know, just all mixed up. Every shovel has stones in it. Every hole that you dig is going to have a lot of that stuff. And then, you know, they're the bigger ones and they're the frost heaves that lift out the bigger and the smaller ones to the surface. So if you want to farm, you got to get those things out of the way. So that's what we have. It's kind of a feature of this part of the Northeast. And I'm not at all surprised that you found the same thing up in Vermont. I mean, it's different up there, but not radically different in terms of when people moved in and what they were doing. People, meaning Europeans, farming. Yeah. As opposed to the populations that were here before. And that's a whole other can of worms.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. I have no idea. I would see one of those things and was like, look at this. This is super cool. And they're like, yeah, we'll keep walking, buddy. We're not to the shovel testing area yet. So I'm like, all right. Yeah. Had no idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, I ran into two barbed wire lines and we didn't have to even record those. And that's something that we would have, in many cases in Nevada, have recorded if they were, you know, on wooden posts as opposed to metal posts.
Oh, sure.
Actually, I literally ran into one of them. I thought, oh, yeah. Didn't expect that here, but it was right along one of those stone walls in the woods.
The vegetation just reminds me of another really quick story. Working in, I want to say, either South Carolina or Georgia. I think it was South Carolina. Vines and prickly bushes and things are just the name of the game. And if you don't have a machete or something else on you, then you're using like your shovel to basically hack brush when you're trying to walk your line to your next shovel test. And I'll never forget thinking I wanted to stay on transect. And I went and we had these little box screens, not like the big stand up ones. So we were carrying just little box screens. And I hucked the box screen up over this series of vines to kind of stay on transect because I had to go way around this. I just couldn't get around this brush. And of course it got stuck like 15 feet up in the air in this brush. And then I was like, ah, son of it. I was trying to pull down the vines to get the screen out. So then I threw my shovel at the screen to try to knock that out. And the shovel got stuck up there. And it took me like another 30 minutes just to get them both down. I was like, I'm going to Nevada.
Yeah. No, we had lots of that. It was the brush gets really dense. And everything, the more dense it is, the more thorns and prickers there are, I'm convinced.
Oh, yeah.
One thing, actually, I did want to mention that I really liked about the way that they had is that the GIS team pre-plotted in Collector the locations of the shovel tests. So then we went out with iPads, and with the GPS on the iPads, you basically plop yourself on the point. So rather than having to walk a transect, you know, with your compass to sight a line down there and then pace out, you just go until it lights up green and then you tap, add a new layer. They had all the different kinds of points pre-programmed. So, you know, once I dug, if it was a positive shovel test or a negative shovel test, I just added the right kind of point and then all the different descriptors.
Well, it sounds like that company has a really good digital archaeology strategy. And
hey, nice segue.
I don't know if they've read this article. My guess is they've been doing that for a long time. And, you know, a lot of people could take a page out of their methodology, but that's what we're going to talk about today is an article from the SA Archaeological Record. And I'll let Paul introduce it because he found it.
Okay, so found it. It showed up in my email inbox, thanks to the SAA. It's in the latest edition of the SAA Archaeological Record, and the name of the article is Why Digital Archaeology, a Case Study from Monte Alban, Oaxaca, by Mark N. Levine and Alex E. Badillo. And short little read, anybody that has access to this and that listens to our podcast, I think we'll find this interesting. You can blow through it pretty quickly, but it just gives an example, a case study, and an argument too. And the argument is what I found the most interesting for how they went about their research design and why they think that digital archaeology is a valid framework. So the first thing that before I even got into the article, just reading the intro, it reminded me of, you're familiar with ODATE, right? The
I think we've talked about
the Open Digital Archaeology textbook. And so Sean Graham et al., right in their intro, they have a pretty robust argument defense of digital archaeology as its own term. And this is, long-term listeners to this podcast know, you and I say that digital archaeology might be kind of an anachronistic term now because everybody does stuff digitally. But ODATE and also this article take a slightly different turn, which is that just because you're doing stuff with computers doesn't make it digital. And that's what we're complaining about, I think.
Yeah.
You can't call it digital just because you did part of it, you know, in a GIS or you did part of it with a database. Certainly not if you did it with, you know, Excel or word processor, because those are just taken for granted at this point. But this article says, hey, if you think about digital all the way through, digital archaeology is still a valid framework for approaching your work. And then they, of course, they illustrate it with what exactly they were doing.
Right. So that's, yeah, that's exactly what they start out saying, that, you know, most archaeologists when they, and I don't know what they mean by most or how much research they did on that, but I would probably say in CRM, at least, it's probably true that a lot of archaeology projects, there's a research design based around the literature search, the common questions for that area. A lot of times in CRM, the controlling agencies have contexts that have been written for certain areas, and you'll read those historical or prehistorical contexts and you'll come up with a research design based on that. And there are going to be a lot of questions based around, you know, transportation and subsistence and, you know, just things like that. And that's typically where the strategizing kind of ends. It's like, okay, let's go dig some holes. Let's go do some survey. Let's go do some whatever. But having an actual strategy around the fieldwork and around the questions that you want to answer that does have a heavy digital component is actually a really good idea, because there's certain things that the authors highlight that you may not even have thought about to do. There's some things we're going to talk about in here that if they hadn't actually pre-planned their digital strategy, especially flying all the way to Mexico, because it doesn't sound like they live there. So they fly all the way to Mexico. They got to bring equipment with them. They wouldn't have known what to bring efficiently. They can't just bring everything. So they would have known what to bring, how to use it, how to maximize the time that they have there in order to actually answer some of the questions and produce some of the things that they did without coming up with this strategy.
Right. Now, key factor in what their defense of that term, quote unquote, digital archaeology, and what they illustrate in this is that their data collection is all born digitally, right? It's born digital. And that just kind of naturally leads them in the kinds of questions they're asking and the kinds of tools they want to use, all the way through collection, processing, analysis, and presentation, all stay within a digital or digital adjacent realm. Which I think is absolutely valid. And I don't fault them for calling it digital archaeology. I don't fault anybody for calling their work digital archaeology. I just think that it deserves a little pushback if you're calling it digital and all you're doing is collecting your data on an iPad in the field. That's the big digital part of it. Yeah, that's born digital. And that's a good use of digital tools, but I don't think it sets you apart anymore. And so what they're trying to do is show that a research design that end-to-end is digital, that can still be this digital archaeology.
Yeah, and one of the links that we have in here came from the article is for the Monte Alban Digital Archaeology Project. There's a website, the MADAP, or however you say that, project. And I understand in a 2021, from an SEO standpoint, putting digital archaeology in the title of your website and probably all over the website, because there's still a lot of people searching the terms digital archaeology when they don't really know what they're looking for. There's too many technological avenues that you could go down. And it's just like, what do I even do? I don't know what to type in. I don't know what a volumetric study is based on 3D photogrammetry. How would I even know that? So I'm going to type in digital archaeology and see what other people have done. So I get that. But I do hope, more to our original point of our criticism of the term digital archaeology, that we can just go to a website called the Monte Alban Archaeology Project, and there would be a heavy digital component that is just part of it, because we would expect that. So, you know.
Yeah, I think that expectation kind of comes and goes depending on how your data are being generated. You know, if you're dealing with a project that has legacy materials, it can't be born digital, right? It's all on index cards and field notebooks and such. You can digitize it and then turn it into digital, but it's not going to be born digital. If you're doing excavation, you know, it can only be so digital because you can't excavate digitally yet.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of gray here. But again, I like their approach in defense of the use of that term of saying, hey, we're going to do this end to end. And so for that, for me, as opposed to you just want it to be the Monte Alban archaeological project, I don't mind that digital archaeology in there in this particular case, because this particular project is heavily foregrounded with the digital.
It is. So let's go ahead. We're going to take a break here, but while we're on break, in case you are, you know, at your computer or smartphone and clicking on some of these links, if you click on the link to the article, if you're on a smartphone or a tablet, it may not work. But if you're on a full-size computer with a browser, spread your window out just a little bit, just in case it's not taking up the full screen, because I did not do that when I first was reading this article. And they were referencing some figures in the article that I couldn't see, and there were seemingly no links for it. And then when I expanded my browser out a little bit, the links on the side appeared, and I clicked on the little book-shaped link, and it opened up the digital magazine version of the essay Archaeological Record with all the images right where you would expect to see them. So don't forget to do that if you're not seeing the figures that are represented.
Yeah, I put a comment to that on our show notes. Because yeah. I was absolutely baffled. I was reading on my iPad and they kept on referencing figures. I'm like, this must be some fault in editing of the archaeological record. And then, you know, when we were talking before recording, you went and pointed out to me, oh, that button on the left. I was like, yeah, I clicked that button on the left a bazillion times. I clicked all the buttons. And all I could do was toggle between the table of contents and this reader view of the article that didn't have any images at all.
Yeah.
But yeah. Is there on my computer? And oh, look at that. There are the images in all their full color glory. Actually, to me, that just highlights one of the slight gotchas with digital in general. And it's not just digital, because it can certainly happen in the analog world, but making sure things are obvious and accessible and usable to the end user. I mean, I'm reasonably tech savvy, I think, and that I didn't figure that out. Try it on a different device, blow up the screen, click the buttons again, means that it's not probably as easy as it should be. That's not the fault of the authors of the article at all. It's probably not even really the SAA's fault. It's the fault of this viewer, this online
using a third party
article reader that they've got that was not done right.
Yeah.
Oh, and now that I've done that, I could download the PDF, which would have made me so much happier, because I would have downloaded the PDF onto my iPad and read it the way I wanted to in the first place.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Well, with that note, and by the way, I'm not some tech genius either. I found it accidentally because I clicked on another link and just wanted to see it bigger and went back to the article and, oh, hey, what are these buttons doing? So, you know, found it just randomly. All right. Well, with that note, I should end it like an episode of The Grand Tour and say, well, on that great disappointment, let's end this segment and go to segment two back in a minute.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to episode 165 of the Archaeotech Podcast, and we are talking about an article that you can find in our show notes from the SAA Archaeological Record, and it's all about coming up with your digital archaeological strategy for a project. This is a case study from a Monte Alban project. So we're going to talk about that here in a second, but the authors define, for them, digital archaeology as the methods used to produce, analyze, visualize, or transform digital data. So that's what they're talking about here. Anything that you're using to do one of those things helps you do that. And I want to go back real quick to the name of the website and the whole digital aspect in there. because I did go through the website quite a bit. They do highlight a lot of the strategies and things that they used, but the end result of all that and the end result of the entire website, just like this whole project, is to learn more about Monte Alban and the questions they were trying to answer about the people and the places that live there. So from that standpoint, I mean, if you really want to be pedantic about it, it's the Digital Anthropology Project. But, you know, it really was just the Monte Alban Archaeology Project, because it's not about the techniques. It's about the results. And the results say the plaza we use was used this way for this amount of time, you know, X, Y, Z. It's standard. Those kinds of questions in archaeology, the way that we answer those and what we're looking for, I don't think are ever going to change regardless of our technology. But the way we get to those answers is, of course, changing dramatically. And that's what we're talking about.
Right. And that's interesting that you're saying the anthropology of it and such. The criticism that gets leveled a lot, and this is actually mentioned in that ODATE introduction, when people talk about digital archaeology, is this notion of foregrounding the tools, right?
Yeah.
To the point of the tools are more important than whatever you learn from them,
yeah,
whatever questions
yeah.
you ask, whatever answers you can get. The fact that you did it with, you know, 3D modeling and beautiful rendering and whatnot is in and of itself enough. Now, it could be if your point is, you know, is outreach and you want to show people a pretty picture that's going to get them interested in learning more about your site, your project, the culture, the history, whatever. But yeah, that's a trap that we can fall into really easily, mm-hmm. is just using the whiz bang toys because they're whiz bang and they're fun, you know, for people like you and me.
Yeah.
But they are really focused on still examining archaeological questions with what they're doing. The mm-hmm. digital tools are being described and being used extensively, but the tools aren't the end result. They aren't really the point even of this article. The fact that they use the tools is a point of the article, but what they were able to ask because of those tools that they use, that's really the point. And so I think that's a fine line to draw then with digital archaeology writ large, you know, so it becomes a continuum again, right? Between us discarding the fact that you use an iPad for data collection as not really being digital archaeology, even though we find it valuable, all the way to the far other end where the digital takes more importance than the archaeology. You're writing about the tools. And mind you, we've discussed certain articles on this podcast in the past that discuss the tools, but that's always in the context of like a how-to. Here's what I tried to do, and here's what worked, and here's what didn't.
Yeah.
They're saying, we used all these tools, and these are the things that we did with them, but these are the great questions that we could ask archaeologically and anthropologically based off of the fact that we did them with these tools. And the tools mm-hmm. are critical to them being able to ask those questions, but not the point of it.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to take away from people writing articles like this, because this is how other people learn about all these tools, of course. So I don't want to make it sound like we're trying to say this is a negative way to do something by any means. But I guess I'm really looking forward to a future where, you know, every project uses some form of GPS, right? And in fact, one of the first things they talk about here was using a total station. I mean, we've been using total stations in archaeology. I mean, total stations have been around for a long time, but in archaeology, we've probably been using them for what, 3 decades or more? So, you know, it's old news, right? It's just expected that you're going to use something like that on a project like this. Any sort of full-scale excavation, I mean, there better be a total station out there or something that can record submeter points in that level of accuracy. So
yeah, to their credit, the total station, they just say we used it for recording microtopography. Yeah. They didn't say what kind of total station, what programs they used to process it. That was all assumed. Just like if you were writing something in a word processor, you're not going to say, hey, this was written in Word, or this was written, I might say it was written in LaTeX, but that's because I'm a weirdo.
I want to do like a joke article to the Archaeological Record about the digital archaeology of report writing and be like, well, I used Word and I used the thesaurus feature and actually, you know, just like get real technical about it.
I use tab stops. That's why I'm better than all the rest of you.
That's right. Tabs, not spaces. Get out of here.
Rookies.
Oh, man. That's right. Anyway, one of the next things that they mentioned too was actually their drone mapping, and that's also almost becoming a little bit normal. You know what I mean? It's falling. Drones are starting to fall into the realm of total stations where they don't. They still mention they use the DJI Phantom 4 Pro and some of their methodology and things like that, because it is important for your strategy. Because I was happy when they put up some numbers. So they flew a total of 46 flights. I don't know how long they were down there, but 46 flights is actually quite a bit. And high altitude at 45 to 60 meters and low altitude at 15 to 25 meters. I don't know if those were split evenly, but that's what they did. And they took over 15,000 photos for a total of 105 gigabytes of data. Now, actually, 15,000 photos, and I was kind of thinking only 105 gigabytes, but, you know, the 4K photos of the DJI, that's probably, it's not taking like raw photos, but it's taking good enough photos for some pretty high quality photogrammetry. And they did mention using ground control points, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. Those help anchor your model in real space. You can produce a model without anchor control points, without ground control points. But if you put in ground control points, then they measure those with a total station. And now you can take that model and anchor it in the real world. Otherwise, it's just floating in the ether, but then you can put it in real space and then you can have real measurements and all that stuff based on that. So I thought doing that stuff was kind of cool, but if this were not an article about a digital archaeological strategy, I'm not certain they would have even mentioned the equipment or their methods. They would have just said, hey, we produced a photogrammetric model about this, and that's how common it's becoming.
Yeah, no, actually, that point then kind of goes against what I was just saying, that they, in this case, they are foregrounding the use of some equipment that is becoming increasingly common. I don't think we mentioned with this article, what they're doing is work started in 2017, and it was carried out to examine the changing role in the meaning of the main plaza at Monte Alban through time, right? So they had some questions. They had some research questions they wanted to ask, and these are the tools that they went to try to answer that. Now, the other reason why this one caught my attention, this article caught my attention, is because in a couple of weeks, I'm supposed to go to Iraq to go do something very similar to what they're doing. I'm supposed to be going out there to fly a drone to make a new map of a site called Lagash in southern Iraq in Dikar Governorate. I don't know if you remember from a couple months ago when I was in Nevada with you, and we were on the archaeology show, and there was an article about a bunch of sites in Dikar. Anyhow, that's down in the south. And it's a really large site, around 450 hectares. So we've been having these meetings discussing the equipment. Interestingly enough, the equipment that we're going to be using is also a DJI Phantom 4 Pro, just like they used in this article. And so we're trying to get a sense of how long it's going to take, how many flights we're going to have. So this is all good information for me to have to strategize my own work. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me is that, you know, because we're dealing with such a big area on this Iraq project, the initial pass through, the person that ran it through drone deploy was talking about 80 meters, which seems too high for me, but it's a huge area that we got to cover. This particular, the Monte Alban project, is interesting to me in that they're doing these two levels, as far as I know, because they have two different levels of resolution that they want, because they don't just want the topography. What I'm looking at Lagash is I'm just going to be doing the topography, you know, what the site looks like. And then we can get some good topo, some good contour maps off of that. What they were doing here with this is not just the topographical features, but also in much more detail, because it has standing stone architecture. They were doing closer in work, low altitude work around those buildings on the site. And then those buildings then become what they move forward with in some of these later stages of this project, which is really cool. But, you know, to your point about this stuff becoming, you know, commonplace on so many archaeological projects, in my preparations for going to Iraq, earlier today, I was watching a video, very good one, I had a link it as well, put together by a land surveying company, talking to other land surveyors about, hey, do you want to get into drone surveying? Here's what the costs are, here's what the considerations are, here's what you need to know, how you do it. They also end up recommending that same DJI Phantom 4 Pro because of its simplicity. I mean, this is from 2018. So in 2018, this person knew enough about doing drone surveying professionally as a land surveyor that he could put together a very well argued, very easy to understand hour-long presentation that's, you know, up on YouTube now of how to go about it for other land surveyors. So it's not something new. And so you're right. This is, we should be getting over this at this point, even though I'm mm-hmm. going to be taken out to do the drone surveying. And, you know, I would like it to be the high-tech whiz-bang thing that I've always wanted it to be, but it's yeah. probably not so high tech, so whiz bang anymore because so many people are doing it.
Well, and including in your strategy too, which is something people haven't necessarily had to think about before, except for like logistics from vehicles and lodging and stuff like that standpoint. We always have to think about that for remote archaeology projects. But also just looking at the numbers here, which is why I'm glad they put this thing down, because people are like, oh, I've got a Phantom, or the university has a Phantom, and we can bring one of those out on the project. Yeah. Don't bring just one like 32 gig SD card or micro SD card. It probably takes a micro. And don't just bring that. Bring like 20 of those, right? Because and then bring something to dump those onto as well, because you don't want to go through multiple airport security checkpoints with your all of your data on your micro SD cards. No, that is just a really bad idea. So
that was one of the things I brought up yesterday in our pre-planning meeting. Yeah. I was like, we need to have at a minimum 2 portable hard drives that we can dump all our images onto nightly. And then we'll send them back. You know, we're not all flying in from the same place, so we'll send them on different flights back just in case something happens.
Yeah, and I don't know what your guys's, you know, lodging situation is going to be too, but you also have to think about batteries. How many do you have? Mm-hmm. How many flights can you do a day on the batteries that you have? Can you charge those batteries in the field, or do you have to charge them up at night when you're in the wherever you're staying? Stuff like that.
Oh yeah, we've been having back and forth emails about that. Currently, we've got 4 batteries. I'm arguing for 2 to 4 more, and basically, you know, that device should get 17 to 20 minutes per battery charge, which basically means, ideally. So I'm rounding down to 15 minutes. And so that means that an hour flight time per 4 batteries. And then we can calculate out from there. And then how many days we're at that 80 meter elevation that they calculated the other day, that would be 8 to 10 days. We have 3 weeks total. So, you know, we're just doing a lot of very basic math here, but it's a balance between time in the field, expense. And like you said, can we actually get these things charged? Yes, we have good electricity. We'll be able to get them charged. But if we're going to stay on schedule, it means that we got to get all 4 to 8 batteries charged fully every day. Because we're going to use them up fully every day.
Right.
That's part of the whole process.
Well, and the other things you have to take into concern with battery life is the frequency with which you're taking photos, which also brings into concern the type of micro SD card as well. I found this out the hard way when I had my DJI Inspire Pro. It was my first real high quality drone with a 4K camera on it. I popped just like a micro SD card in there. And it almost wouldn't take the photos in the highest resolution because the card wasn't writing fast enough for the machine to do it. And so I was doing some photogrammetry and I had set it up to take pictures on an interval that was too fast for the card to write. So, you know, keeping that in mind, you know, a higher altitude actually for this larger survey is actually a pretty good thing for you, because you can take fewer pictures at a higher altitude at a longer interval, because you're just looking for an overlap, and the higher you are, the bigger your field of view. So, you know, fewer pictures. And unless you're going 30 miles an hour, then you're going to be taking pictures pretty fast, but you're probably not. So, the two other big factors, as long as you got a good high write speed SD card, is wind. Wind will take down a drone battery like nothing, because sure, that looks like a rock solid photo, but it is working hard to stay steady. And then the frequency with which you're taking photos, because that also, you're more than likely taking pretty high resolution photos, and that burns a lot of power. So to be honest, I'd probably predict about 10 minutes per battery, just to be on the safe side. And if you get an hour, call yourself lucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you're also going to have the out and back time too, so you're gonna you're gonna program drone deploy, and your last transect battery life wise may end, you know, a long ways away from you, and then the drone's got to come back doing nothing, dead walking if you will, dead flying all the way back to you, and that battery life has to be taken into account. That could be a minute, you know, and when you're looking at 10 to 15 minutes, that's a, you know, 10 to
that's a big chunk
5
of it,
to 10% of your battery.
Oh, and don't forget, the drones, they ascend faster than the descent.
Oh, yeah.
So getting it up to 80 meters is going to take me 20 seconds, half a minute, maybe. Getting it back down is going to take me 2 minutes at least.
Well, not if you run the battery down.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I could just shut the rotors off and I could get down within a couple seconds, but
just get a big net out there, drop it over the net to save battery.
Yeah. I'll just put it over and try to catch it.
Nice.
It's not like it's a big drone or anything that's going to hurt like hell.
Oh, man. Yeah. All right. Well, that's about it for this segment. Let's come back on the other side and wrap up this article. This has really spawned some good discussion. And that's the whole point of an article like this, because people don't think about these really minute details unless they've really had experience with it. So I'm glad we're talking about this. Let's come back on the other side and finish this up. Back in a minute.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the final segment of episode 165 of the Archaeotech Podcast. And we are wrapping up this discussion on developing your own digital archaeological strategy based on the article linked in the show notes from the SA Archaeological Record of, well, what, August or September of 20, I think September of 2021 just came out. So,
yep, September 21, volume 21, yeah. Number 4.
Yeah. And, you know, something I wanted to mention, because Paul's going to, if you look at the show notes, there's a link to that video Paul was talking about with the survey company and some things to consider when you're doing these drone surveys. Is archaeology is a little late to the game with some technologies. There's very few things that are being developed in-house. Now, maybe some strategies or techniques using certain technologies are being developed by archaeologists because they haven't been used in this way. That is 100% valid. But basic use and function of some of these things, other industries have been doing this for a lot longer than archaeologists have. So if you're curious about these things, just, I mean, Google it. I hate to say that, but Google it and find the videos, find other industries. And it might not say archaeology on it, but that's probably for the best, because these people know what they're doing. They've, you know, worked out all the kinks, and they know the best practices. Of course, you got to put your archaeological lens on it. If they're saying, if it's a surveying company and they're like, fly it 1,000 feet over the ground, because, you know, all you care about is where are the roads and the fence lines, you know, think about what you can see as an archaeologist. Maybe that's true on a Nevada project. If all you're doing is a road survey, yeah, 1,000 feet is probably acceptable, but, you know, think about what you're trying to see. You know, this Monte Alban project is a really good example of that. Like you said, you don't need to fly that low in Iraq because you're not looking for minute details in the stone and rocks and things like that, like these guys are at Monte Alban. That's why they're flying such a low altitude pass. So,
yeah, no, back to that surveying video. One of the things that they do mention, it comes up kind of obliquely in the video, but it definitely comes out in the Q&A at the end of the webinar, is that they use multiple systems. Yeah. They're using the drones because most of the work that you do as a land surveyor can actually be done much more quickly and efficiently that way. But there's certain detail work, things around like where power lines run or where drainage is, you know, or drains rather, or gutters run, that, yeah, you could do that photogrammetrically, but you can do it much more accurately and in some ways faster with your total station. And then they combine those things at the end. Yeah. And I just like that because, you know, we do have a tendency to get stuck in this is the best tool rather than this is the most appropriate tool for this particular job or this particular part of the job. And seeing that, you know, land surveying is, compared to archaeology, is a much bigger industry in the US at least, and probably worldwide, that they are dealing with their own knowledge and their own expectations and time constraints that aren't unlike what we have in archaeology to get things done, to have producibles at the end. It was nice to see that it, you know, other people from a different field thinking the same sort of ways. Like you said, you have to put the archaeological lens onto it, but geez, there's a lot that you can learn by looking outside of just archaeology.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know, this isn't a drone episode, although I feel like it's one of our favorite topics.
Kind of almost turned into one.
I know. But one thing I was thinking about, especially for the Iraq project, I don't know if you guys are doing this level of survey, but I was thinking of the survey video, and I haven't seen it yet, but when you're doing a big land survey and you're looking for either overall topography or really big features, you know, you're not looking for the minute detailed stuff yet at this level, sometimes fixed wing is actually the way to go. Because fixed wing is faster, more battery efficient. It's not trying to center itself and right itself with the wind. Still has stabilizers on their cameras, but it's just it'll fly it at higher altitudes at a faster speed with only one propeller versus four that are trying to maintain stability at all times. And you can just get a lot more time and distance out of the battery and still get the same quality of photographs. Now, you're never going to fly fixed wing at 20 meters. I guess you could if you're in a desert environment, but people don't generally do that because you're too close to the ground, right, for that kind of speed. I don't think cameras and cards that are typically available in those types of machines can handle that kind of speed that close to the ground and not have any blurring effects. So even at a really high shutter speed.
I can tell you're an aviation guy because they do talk about that. And those are the exact things that they say. It's like, well, it's nice. Generally the fixed wing drones are more expensive. There's some concerns about the cameras and the fact that you don't have like a gimbal in the same way that you do a quadcopter. But if you need to cover a large tract of land and less detail, they are maybe a very good option. But again, like you just said, you can't fly too close to the ground because you get motion blur. You got to be up high. So yeah, in our case, you know, Lagash is some 450 hectares roughly. Mm-hmm. So 1,000 acres. That's a big site.
That's a lot.
A fixed wing might actually be better, especially considering that we're plotting out, you know, 80 meter elevation to fly. A fixed wing might be a better choice. Problem is we don't have one.
I mean, it comes down to access, right? They are way more expensive, and especially for one that can handle wind. Like, you can buy cheaper ones with cheaper cameras and smaller engines, but they're made out of foam, and a 5 mile an hour wind will destroy them. So just like lighter drones, right? So, and other, there's another complexity too. Even if you do buy a $10,000 fixed wing drone with a high speed camera on it, you might be wondering, how am I going to fly this thing? Because flying a drone is relatively easy. When you let go of the sticks, it just hovers and you just have to learn the controls and figure it out. And you can get used to that. And it's a lot more forgiving when it comes to mistakes. And there's really good software out there to actually control the drone. So you can just put in a flight path and say go, and it just does the whole thing for you, which is obviously nobody in their right mind would do a manual photogrammetric survey. You would just take way too many photos or not enough in certain areas and get it all wrong. So, you know, planning it out. It would be terrible. Yeah. But for fixed wing, they also have the same thing. The higher end ones, like I think Trimble, is it Trimble? I think Trimble actually makes one, or at least they highlight one that has some Trimble geospatial stuff inside of it. That will actually fly a course for you. You might have to do some, like they usually hand launch with a takeoff and then you just hit go and the engine starts up and it takes off and flies its own course. And then usually they just glide back with no landing gear onto the ground. And that's pretty much it. And the propellers are designed to fold back and not get destroyed. And they're really good these days. So don't think the flying skills are any more rigorous when flying a fixed wing, especially if you got good software to control it. If you don't have software, they're much more difficult to fly. You have to know how to fly a plane, to be honest, and understand those mechanics. But
if you don't have the software, it's like the old radio control planes that you and I cut our teeth on.
Yeah, and you'll cut a lot more than that if you know how to fly it. So,
especially if you're using one of the old internal combustion engines and you got to start it with the chicken stick or something.
My grandpa had this old piece of like thick rubber to start his. He was really into model airplanes, built all his own planes and built his own radios even, and just like was crazy with it. And he, for the longest time, I don't remember a time when he didn't have this, but he was missing a piece of his index finger, just like a little bit of it, because he got caught up in a prop that started when he didn't think it was going to. He was going in for another strike and it took off the end of his finger. Yeah. So I think if you go to an RC airfield, you're going to find way more, you know, not 10 fingered people, or not like 9 3/4.
All the old timers that were using gas engines instead of electric, right?
Oh man. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the last half of the segment, some of the other stuff that they did with the 3D data that they were collecting. Cause a lot of the rest of what they did was actually produced from the combination of the total station, the drone data, and probably, I would imagine, a lot of other photographs that they didn't really mention. Again, a technology that's not mentioned. I'm sure they had a digital SLR out there and took a crap ton of photographs, but they just didn't mention that, right? So, and why would they? But the, you know, the drone takes, sure, it's probably an off angle photo, you know, it's probably angled a little bit, and then they fly over all these passes to get the sides of things. And when you put it all together, it comes together. But sometimes you might have to fill in with other stuff. And that's one of the things that they did. I hadn't really seen this term too many times, but they said they created the 3D model, and then they were filling in the gaps of the features and the structures to make them, quote, watertight. So you can, there's different lighting techniques you can use in the software to say, are there actually any holes in my model, like actual holes in your model where there's no data? And then they'd, you know, see if they had the data for that from another photograph or something like that. And then when they did that, they did what they call a volumetric study using the literal volume of the features, and then comparing that with past studies to find how the sizes and shapes of these things have changed through time, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, right. Just as a side note, that that watertight, I've seen that term used in 3D modeling and in 3D printing. And basically means, you know, you don't have any gaps. That's what we're talking about with holes. That you fill them in. And usually when you have like some area that you haven't surveyed or some area that the camera couldn't see, or the sensors or whatever kind couldn't see, you can use your own brain to figure it out. And I've had to deal with that with like Landsats or SRTM DEMs trying to map stuff on Earth for, you know, from satellite photography, satellite imagery, where, you know, you've got a spot that for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's too vertical. That's a good reason. You have that a lot. There's no data for it. And so instead of going down to zero or null, you say, no, it's actually halfway between, you know, this side and that side, and you fill it in. And then that's kind of work gets done in things like Blender a lot. But then they're doing these. So this actually gets to the point of them doing the two different elevations. If my supposition that they're doing those low elevations and all those oblique shots, it was because of the architecture. They're doing that to fill in and make highly detailed architectural models, which they then use, like what you said, for volumetric study amongst a few other display methods that I thought were really cool that they talked about. Again, nothing earth shattering, nothing that you haven't seen before, but a good, robust argument for the end-to-end digitalness of their workflow.
Yeah, and two of those other studies too remind me a lot of a relatively common thing in archaeology using GIS, which is a viewshed analysis, you know, basically creating a viewpoint somewhere on your map and then having the map shade in, you know, what can't you see if you're standing right here topographically, right? You're on this point, what's invisible to you? And we use that a lot for like historic and prehistoric features and structures where, you know, is the thing that we're building over here going to be in view of this thing? And does that view, if so, negatively impact the character of it or something like that, or the setting or the feeling, you know, one of those typical National Register or NEPA qualifications.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're using it in the CRM context, you know, to find out like what impact, say you have a sacred site, is that radio tower going to be visible from the sacred site? Is that going to negatively impact the sacredness of that site? Sure. I've used it and seen it used in you know, more purely archaeological studies. It's like, can you see this hill fort from that hill fort?
Right.
You know, if invaders are coming across the fields, can these two hill forts be in communication, light flares or whatever, to indicate that something's afoot? So, yeah. But anyhow, the intervisibility gets used a lot of different ways in and view sheds get used a lot of different ways in archaeology, CRM and academic.
Yeah.
Again, like I said, it's not something new, but they used it as part of this, and they used it because they had data that was amenable to it.
Well, and I feel like the new aspect of this, new-ish anyway, is you often think of those visibility and viewshed analyses on a larger scale. Like you said, is this hill fort visible from that hill fort kind of thing? Whereas when you get down to the smaller scale, the more micro scale versus the macro scale, GIS becomes, I would say, more difficult to use. Not that it's incapable of doing it, but I would say more difficult because we often haven't collected the data to that level of resolution to be able to do that. But when you start producing these photogrammetric models and these 3D models that they mentioned this future things that they're doing. They're working with some other companies to actually produce virtual reality models from the stuff that they've created to, mm-hmm. I mean, literally step into these models. And they were able to do this intervisibility study and the archaeoacoustical study without stepping into the model, but they actually can step into it in some cases and literally stand on a platform and say, what can I see from here? And then do an acoustical study and do the same thing. What does it sound mm-hmm. like? How would sound waves propagate around this area if I'm standing here versus 10 feet away?
Yeah, right. And that's interesting, actually, that you mentioned their intervisibility isn't between this plaza and, you know, another site in the valley. They're talking about intervisibility within the plaza.
Yeah.
Which then allows you to ask certain interesting questions about, you know, the use of that space, particularly the ritual use of that space. Mm-hmm. You know, I know you've never been to church, but for anybody that's ever been to church,
not in a long time,
where you sit in the building affects how you can see and hear what the priest is saying.
Yeah.
And that kind of an understanding of the use of the space and how vision is affected by the physical space and the buildings in this case, or pillars or whatever you've got going on in the church. Mm-hmm. And then also the acoustical properties of the area really affects how people experience that. And that gets us back to that anthropological question that what we mostly care about is how would people in the past have experienced this? What was their role there? Why were they there? What were they doing there? How would they have been part of whatever was going on there?
Yeah.
And so they are actually using this then. They don't actually go into detail in the article about any kinds of results that they find from this, but they do say, hey, we're using it for these purposes, intervisibility and archaeoacoustics, which is, again, cool. And again, also only possible because they've got good data that started and was controlled and processed every step of the way digitally. Again, strong argument in favor of maintaining that term, digital archaeology.
Absolutely. So I love the discussions this is put together here. And one of the last things that they actually mention almost as an I feel like it was almost as an afterthought again in the article was the 3D printing, which is itself becoming more and more common in archaeology. But, you know, when it comes down to actual usability of 3D models like this, unless you've got a really big 3D printer, producing this plaza would be either really small or lots of pieces you got to put together. Yeah. Unless you've got, like I said, a really big 3D printer. And then, you know, they work at a university. There might be a one that will do a 1 foot or 2 foot cube 3D print, which would be pretty big. But that being said, even if you're putting together smaller models or you're putting together pieces to actually construct this thing and glue it together, imagine when you're back in university and somebody's telling you about Monte Alban and you've got a slide up on the screen or a movie or even you're watching or something that you're seeing, that's one thing. And kids are on their smartphones and they're falling asleep and you know, they're just not paying attention. But put a model in front of them and say, look at this and touch it, feel it, pick it up, pick up the temple and see what it does, and then move it around and let's explore the different configurations that may have been possible and look how they did it. And I don't know, the teaching ability and the excitability of, you know, getting people excited about stuff like that is huge, mm-hmm. I think, with 3D printing.
No, and, you know, they do have, now that I can see the pictures, they do have some images of the 3D printer, which looks to be a fairly large one, but it's a regular, you know, extruded plastic, like, what you know, you can buy, like, what I've got sitting on my desk, only larger than this one.
It is a big one.
And what I'm seeing here just reminds me of, you know, you've been to places where you see like a reconstruction of the city, right? Yeah. Laid out in front of you, like the famous one for Rome.
Right.
Or you've seen like model train sets, and there's something that's just really engaging about them. You know, even though like the model train set is a very old tech, you stand there and you look at it and you just get you get absorbed into it. So I see that this as a teaching and or engagement tool is really strong, or potentially very strong, because just looking at the photographs of this, I kind of want to, like you were saying, pick up and hold and handle and turn around these things. I don't know if you remember, we had Alexei Vranich on a couple years ago, and he was talking about doing this with a building for Tiwanaku. And his 3D printing was using a different material. It wasn't the extruded plastic. And that was part of the process, was using a different material to try to get the sense of how the blocks fit together and how the building actually looked, because it had been totally dismantled or almost totally dismantled.
Yeah.
But I definitely see that tactile sense. Really, for me, I'm a very tactile person. When I see these photographs they've got in the article, that excites me. Mm-hmm. And before we run way too long, let's just mention briefly that they also say they use the 3D models, not just for making 3D prints, but also for making 3D models that they posted up on Sketchfab, annotated in some cases, bilingually in English and Spanish, so that you as the viewer can go in and explore it on your computer at your own leisure. You don't actually have to go and hold or print out, you know, these 3D objects, which again is something that is only possible in this whole digital workflow that they have, but then provides additional avenues for exploration and education. And I'm all about that. That is really kind of very cool. And I'm glad that they did that.
Yeah, I like the Sketchfab stuff so much. I pulled it out of the article and dropped it in the show notes. So it's really cool. Yeah, really neat. If you've never even used Sketchfab, man, you can just manipulate things, and they do have it really well annotated, like Paul said. And it's just it's really well done. So, and it's a good example between the website and all the links and resources they have of how to share this kind of thing, right? How to get it out there and not just keep it in your dissertation or your article or this article, or, you know, things that are inaccessible to people. Sure, they've probably written, you know, dozens of scholarly articles about this stuff that we don't have access to because they're in journals that we can't read. That's for their professional reasons. That's for, you know, their own academic careers, of course, but also professional reasons to put that stuff out. But then they've also put all this other stuff out for anyone in the world to see. And I really can respect that about a project. And that's one of the other big things that digital archaeology, for lack of a better way to say it, provides, is the ability to relatively easily share this stuff with a wider audience that, you know, maybe homebound, maybe, you know, COVID bound in their own country and can't get to anywhere. And, you know, who knows? So this is a really good example of that.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. And outreach that this digital process enables, facilitates, I think is a really strong selling point.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we will end this, what we thought was going to be a shorter recording, this really long recording.
We'll hope you enjoyed it. That.
I know it was I enjoyed it. I hope everybody else did too. It was a really fun discussion. Yeah. So anyway, as usual, the links are in the show notes. You can find the article in the show notes, and hopefully you've got access to it. If not, you have access to all the resources they put out. So don't feel sad about not being able to see the article. Just take a look at their website, Sketchfab, and some of the other stuff. So you'll get a pretty good idea of what they did. And with that, we'll see you next time. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.